Good morning, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on where you're calling in from. My name is Audrey, and I will be your host for today's weekly waking call. So welcome, and thank you all for joining us. So for those of you who are dialing for the first time, I just want to share that really the purpose of these calls is just to share stories and to tell stories. And they're all stories that kind of help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. And we do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions and through their way of living in a more service-oriented way. And also behind these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. And we often don't know where it's coming from or from who or where, what part of the world, but it's beautiful to see the way it all comes together. So today, our special guest speaker is Pia Sorkar, and she is someone who has been providing health education and breaking taboos in the world through her Teach AIDS program for free and as a gift. And so we're really excited to learn more about your experiences. Thank you so much for joining us, Pia. Preeta also is an amazing woman who previously has worked as Obama's lawyer in his first term and is now starting a nonprofit at MIT to use technology for social emergence, and also just an incredible heart of a person who has been also, on the volunteering end of these calls. So Preeta, thank you so much for joining us.
So I'd love to, you all have Pia's bio, and I'll just highlight a few things about her remarkable background. And I want to properly call her Dr. Pia Sarkar, because she has all the wonderful training that is involved in that. She's the founder and CEO of a nonprofit called TeachAids, which was founded in 2009, and it creates educational technology that aims to solve numerous persistent problems, especially focusing on HIV/AIDS prevention around the world. Today, its software is being used by governments, NGOs, and educational institutions in more than 70 countries, including India, South Africa, Botswana, China, and the U.S. She's able to give this software away for free, and she's supported and funded by numerous institutions in order to do that. Prior to TeachAIDS, Pia was a founding member of a few other technology nonprofit startups. She's also been a screenplay consultant for many international award-winning children's educational programs, and she was nominated for a regional Emmy Award for lead actress. And she comes from a long line of artists in her family, and so excited to hear a little bit about how the art has influenced her. She received her PhD and a master's from Stanford, and she's originally from Colorado. Notably, the MIT Technology Review named her in 2011 to its list of the top 35 innovators in the world under 35. So we're really excited to hear from her and very honored to have her here. So, hi, Pia.
Hi. It's an absolute delight to be here, and thank you so much for the opportunity to share a story. And Audrey and Preeta, the very kind things that you've been saying, I'm so grateful to you for allowing us to talk a little bit more about our work.
Great. Well, why don't we start off by, I'd love to just have you talk a little bit about how you got interested in HIV/AIDS prevention in India and kind of how did this become the issue that you began to focus your energy on?
Sure. So it was in late 2005 and 2006 that I started reading these reports coming out of India that said that it was to be the next hot zone for people living with HIV. And what was curious was that despite millions of dollars that had been poured into prevention efforts, the reports were saying that there was limited learning, that basic issues around HIV and AIDS were still unknown. I was curious whether it was the media that was sensationalizing this, or perhaps it was the way the research was conducted. So I ran my own research in India and found exactly the same results. So people had questions, basic questions around, can you get HIV from coughing on someone, sneezing, There were so many different misunderstandings. The number one question that came back was around a cure. So which stage can HIV be cured, and how come certain countries have the cure and others don't, when there was no cure? And again, this was after hundreds of millions of dollars had been poured into trying to solve this problem. And it turned out that, you know, when it comes to a topic like HIV, it's extremely difficult to talk about, let alone teach about. So you're talking about intravenous drug use and commercial sex work and death, and you take all these different taboo topics, put them together, and you come up with needing to talk about HIV. And in India in particular, sex education had been banned across multiple states. And because of that, AIDS education was either watered down or not given. Since they couldn't provide HIV education in a comprehensive way through schools, they were using the mass media. But there's so many challenges in using the mass media when you think about using radio jingles or billboards or television commercials to try to present a very comprehensive and accurate message. So you think about learning about something as basic as math education. We don't learn 2 + 2 is this on one billboard and 3 × 3 is this on another billboard. We learn about it systematically through school. And so you could see the inherent problems in trying to provide education around HIV and other kinds of taboo topics around the world, and in particular at the time in India.
Interesting. So tell me why that surprised you when you first heard that India was a hot zone for HIV, and I guess that would have been around 18 or 20 years after the AIDS epidemic started really being known globally. Why was that a surprise to you, and why did you choose to kind of throw yourself into that research?
The biggest surprise was that we had so many different experts working on this problem at that point, and we had so much money that was being poured into it. So when they had identified India as a hot zone, what the experts were saying was that they had already tackled this problem in countries like South Africa, and that they would be able to take the lessons learned from these other locations and different domains and be able to apply it. So this shouldn't be exploding as a problem in India. And so when we found that all this money had been poured into it and all this expertise from fantastic minds, brilliant minds, and that kids were still not learning, that just didn't make a lot of sense, and I wanted to learn more.
Interesting. So describe kind of how what you started doing about it and how TJ's came about and what it does.
Sure. So TJ's, as you had described it, we have created these interactive software modules to teach about HIV and deal with a lot of the different persistent problems that we found in trying to provide this kind of information. So some of the challenges were things like we'd find different areas that were providing some education, but it wasn't complete education. So in most of the places, they were eliminating the most taboo sections that really needed to be talked about and needed to be discussed within various groups. In other locations, it was an issue around accurate information. So there were a lot of these myths that were around stigma that were being perpetuated. There were other issues like the kinds of graphics and images that were being used to teach about this. There were places where sex education wasn't banned, but educators felt so uncomfortable teaching about this and talking about this that they were burning materials on the streets. Just feeling like this was not something that they knew about enough to talk about, and they also didn't want to be responsible for teaching about something that was life-threatening. And so looking at what kinds of images we would be able to use that would both maximize comfort and maximize learning and therefore maximize efficacy in trying to communicate these kinds of messages. There were all kinds of issues around communication and translation. It just turns out it's very difficult to talk about these subjects, and in many languages, there aren't the kinds of words that you need to be able to communicate and effectively talk about this. And a lot of issues around trust around these education modules. So a lot of the young people that we would talk to, they'd say, well, you know, we're receiving certain information from perhaps our parents or perhaps our teachers, but we don't think that they know enough. And so we had to battle all these kinds of a myriad of different issues in trying to come up with solutions that would then work.
Yeah. So how did you do that? How did you get the trust, and how did you battle that communication issue, and even the taboo issue?
Yeah. So I'll give you a few examples. So when I was talking about the graphics and images, for instance, we tested all different kinds of images that were being used in the field, including creating our own kinds of images. So everything from explicit medical illustrations, which communicated exactly what you wanted to be able to show, but in a lot of cases, these are the images that were extremely uncomfortable or were being banned or burned in different locations, all the way through stick figures, which were extremely comfortable to look at. However, there's only so much information that you can communicate through stick figures. And so in trying to look at all these different kinds of images, what we discovered was that it was these 2D, simple, Disney-style characters that maximized comfort, but we were able to communicate enough information that people would then learn from those materials. With issues around discomfort, what we learned and what the research also shows is that girls like to learn from other females, and boys like to learn from males. And so we ended up creating different gender versions of our materials, where there would be a male learner that was then learning from a male doctor character. And then similarly, we had female versions. The other thing had to do around who was delivering that information. And we work with a number of cultural icons who are extremely respected across different parts of the world. In India, for instance, Shabana Azmi or Amitabh Bachchan, Amol Palekar, and different kinds of actors like this that people have great respect for, who are in the animated material. So the characters in the animations are caricatures of them. And so this trust that people have for these individuals in their personal lives has shown to transfer into how they feel about the materials and how much they then trust those materials.
Wow, that's fascinating. So in terms of that you described, the visuals, making that kind of accessible and comfortable for people, the kind of messenger, whether it's a female or male doctor, and then just kind of cultural icons and other people that can help bring that home to people.
Right. The other thing was just using a biology base to be able to communicate the basics around HIV. So when you think about HIV, it's a virus, and we learn about viruses in biology all the time. So really thinking about how we can pull away from actions related to HIV and not talk about moral judgment and other issues around that, and go back down to the basics of biology and coupling that with culturally appropriate euphemisms in order to communicate these kinds of messages around HIV prevention and treatment and transmission.
Yeah, that's great. How did you, when you started taking on this topic, did you get any pushback from either people kind of immediately around you, your social circle, your family, or even kind of in the field, people saying, what's a nice girl like you doing in this area?
yes, absolutely. And a lot of the things they're saying were exactly what I had faced. So when I picked this topic initially, the first reaction was, is this really still a problem? That HIV had been a problem at the time for more than 25 years. How could this be a problem still in the world? And so that was one thing. But the other issue was that is there a reason why she's picking this subject? Is she HIV infected, or is her husband HIV infected? There must be a reason why someone would select a topic that had a relationship with so many different issues around stigma. And honestly, I didn't even know anyone that was HIV positive when I first started this work. It was truly an interesting problem that I wanted to see if we could learn more about and hopefully be able to solve.
Great. So it sounds like, if I understand you correctly, that you this kind of the problem initially appealed to your heart. There was a research study saying, you know, India was a hot zone. You threw your mind and your energy into understanding that, doing your own research, unraveling it. But it's one thing to see a problem and research it, and then it's another to kind of make the leap and to decide to devote yourself full time to it. At least in my sense, requires more than just a head-based engagement. So what about this whole endeavor of kind of bringing education and awareness around this issue, what about this touched your heart enough that you kind of went all in?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I would say that it's something that happened from when I was a young child, and my parents had really instilled the value of education, and we had been doing nonprofit work for a very, very long time in my family. I come from a family of arts, and when my sister and I were young and growing up in the United States, my parents wanted to teach us a lot about Indian culture and our roots. And so my father started creating these animated productions and having us sing songs. He would write music and compose it. And it started to just be able to teach us about where we came from and our family, and to be really appreciative of the sacrifices that our families had made for us to have the opportunities that we had, both at the time and obviously later in life. And as a part of this work, my sister and I became very engrossed in the productions, which went on to win huge awards at top international film festivals around the world. These productions have been shown on television on PBS for over 25 years. So I really feel like my life went full circle in terms of understanding the importance of education from a very young age, which was instilled by my parents, and then that leading up to what I'm doing now. I was in economic consulting when I graduated college, and I loved the work, and all of it was definitely more the head than the heart. And at the time, we went to India for about 5 weeks, and my sister and I performed as part of my parents' productions in about 21 shows in the 5 weeks. And I remember looking around just the streets of India and the different people that I was meeting and seeing the generosity and the kindness of people and just being reminded of how huge the world is and how much bigger it is than just you. And so when I got back to working in consulting, I actually quit a few days later and decided that I wanted to go into nonprofit-related efforts, and in particular, pursuing the field of education.
Wow. What were these kinds of productions you were doing with your family in India?
Those were large-scale theater shows. So it was dancing and singing and acting, and they were multimedia productions to entertain various folks, but also the really exciting part about it was that each of the productions were created to raise money for different nonprofits to be able to inspire the work that they're doing and inspire others to take action in after learning about the incredible work that was being done.
Wow. So it sounds like kind of multimedia presentations and education through that has been a little bit a part of your heritage.
Exactly. My life, it's interesting, went full circle to think that I was acting in these animated productions that my father had so painstakingly put together when I was young. The fact that now the research demonstrates that these kinds of cartoons and images are the best way to teach about these taboo topics has been really interesting and just such a blessing.
That's amazing. So how did you get, you talked about having these amazing cultural icons part of your, the Shabana Azmi, Amitabh Bachchan, part of the messengers. How did you get to the point where you got on their radar, that you were able to bring in such talent?
So the first reason why we wanted to do that, of course, it's fantastic from a marketing standpoint, but the research had indicated that when you use these kinds of trusted icons, that people learn more, they care more, they trust the information more. And so I knew that we needed to try to get people that really resonated with the populations that we cared about teaching and working with. In terms of bringing the various celebrities on, it's been incredible to see how the power of love and generosity and friendship can bring these things into fruition. So the first person that I brought on, which was Shabana Agni, was through meeting a neighbor of mine who knew someone whose aunt did a lot of work in these kinds of productions. And so the more that people learned about the work that we were doing and the research base and the efficacy around it, the more they were willing to make introductions to people who were then willing to make introductions to more people. So it was really just hard work, persistence, patience, and the generosity of these various people that once they learned about what we were doing, they were all in and they were willing to donate their time and their efforts and in many cases their resources to be able to make this happen for people around the world.
Wow, that's amazing. When you researched this issue and found out that people are not getting the right information, what encouraged you or what led you to think that kind of a technology solution would be the way to go in terms of software versus, let's say, live performances or all kinds of other things, or just even teacher training? Or there's so many ways one could tackle this issue. Just curious what led you to technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's such an important question because many people just jump to technology as the initial solution for different kinds of social problems or other kinds of problems. And we did look at a lot of the different methods that you just named off, because I wasn't sure at the beginning, would it be teachers teaching other teachers, or it would be young people teaching teachers, or, you know, really what it would look like, whether it would be through music or the arts in some other form. But it turned out that when we looked at the different kinds of problems associated with teaching about taboo topics in particular, and of course HIV being the culmination of many different taboos, technology was able to solve many of the problems that had persisted. So an example of that would be around acceptance of the material. So there were many teachers that refused to teach about the topic because of discomfort or because of lack of knowledge, but with using technology, software could be entirely self-driven. And so if there were teachers that wanted to teach about it and be part of the learning experience, they could, but it wasn't required. Another issue was around accuracy of the information, as I was describing earlier. So in a lot of the cases, the education around these topics was incomplete. It was inconsistent. It was inaccurate. But when you're talking about technology, we could make sure that there were virtual teachers and that the same education was provided to learners all of the time. Then there were issues around gender comfort, learning the discomfort around learning from educators of the opposite sex. And so when we created the technology, we could create, again, the virtual teacher that offered gender concordance. There were other issues around looking at learning effects. And when you use technology, you can be very precise in tracking how much people have learned, how have they then used this information, how have they disseminated this information, and how has that changed their attitudes and their behaviors. And, of course, other things like being able to bring these trusted icons right into their classrooms or to their screens or their mobile devices. It'd be very difficult to bring someone like Amitabh Bachchan to every single classroom, but by creating this virtual learning, private learning environment, we were able to accomplish exactly that.
Interestingly, as you're talking, I was thinking of just the communication issues generally, and you know, so many times when you're talking about children's education, we hear that technology, is not necessarily a great solution because people need to be in with their peers, they need to be physically with teachers, and that nothing can replace that kind of interaction. But I was thinking as you were speaking that maybe with culturally taboo topics, actually people need a little bit of space as they
exactly.
as they delve with that topic. They don't necessarily want to be with other people. They want
exactly.
to just... Interesting. And that's interesting just generally in terms of communication. Like when you are talking about kind of difficult topics, just the role of space and privacy and physical space and letting people have the time and space to kind of come to their own, go through their own process in breaking down those taboos.
Yeah, and this whole idea of creating virtual private learning environments when you can. So when we were doing this testing in larger classrooms, a lot of the students said they felt so comfortable because they were learning about this alone. And the interesting part was that they were not alone. They were sitting with all of their classmates. They had their teachers roaming their the halls, and the teachers were in the classrooms themselves. But in a lot of the cases, when the students were using headphones to listen to the information, even though they knew every other student was watching and learning from exactly the same thing, they felt the sense of privacy and that space that you were talking about to be able to learn and grow and think about these kinds of issues. It was really very interesting. The other issue was being able to give them the language through the technology through which they could ask questions. So a lot of the students would be embarrassed to ask the questions because the words that they would use would be ones that they would not necessarily want to use in the classroom. But when we could teach them other words like high-risk fluids or no-risk fluids, and here's how direct transfer or direct transmission occurs in your body, what we would find is that after they went through these materials, they would then use these new words to be able to communicate the questions that they have had for so long.
That's great. So generally, how is this actually used in the classroom? Is it used in the classroom with kids sitting together watching kind of a common screen, or they kind of each have their own console? Or how is this generally used?
It's used in so many different ways, and so we don't dictate the way that it should be used or it could be used. There are some places that have many different computers, so individuals are sitting with one computer or a few computers. In most cases, it's being projected on a wall or a screen with anywhere from dozens to hundreds or even thousands of people watching at the same time. One of the most interesting cases was in Rwanda, where they had the World Cup games, and they had so many people, thousands of people that were walking in from different villages to watch the games on these enormous screens that had been set up in the stadiums. And in between those games, they would watch the teach aids animations. So it's been really interesting to see the innovative ways that people have been using the materials to teach about it. There are other places where they have no electricity, and you find educators or people that are empowered within the communities putting the animations on a computer, like a laptop, which they put on top of a chair, and the chair on a table, and the table in front of the room, and you have all of these young learners that are huddled and watching the animation in a lot of cases in their language, for the watching animations in their local languages for the very first time.
Wow. And how, generally, what is the age of children that the material is aimed at?
That's a great question. So when we had created the materials, it was for young people. So students or young people that were in junior high, like junior high level or high school level. But what we found was after creating the materials and making them available for free, that people across all different generations are using the material. So people from army doctors to teach their soldiers, to corporations that are using it to teach about HIV within their companies, to religious leaders that have said that they've been wanting to teach about HIV for so long, but they didn't have the tools to be able to teach about it the way they wanted to. So using this biology-based approach, many of those religious leaders or people across the political spectrum have been able to use it. So anywhere from young learners to people that are quite a bit older.
Interestingly, so when you say biology-based approach, you say it's taken out of the context of maybe sex and in the context of a virus, as you said. So it's a little bit more clinical.
Exactly. So when you talk about high-risk fluids, we actually talk about the concept of fluids. What are fluids? And tears are fluids, or, you know, blood is a kind of fluid. And so when you start talking about those kind of topics in a more scientific way, when you're talking about them using a biology-based approach, then people we found are more welcome to learning about it.
Fascinating. And have you had any backlash in communities where you've come in, or, and we'll talk about kind of how you come in, but where your software is being offered and used in the teaching material. Are you aware of backlash?
No, we have not. It's been incredible. In the places that I'm talking about where sex education was banned even, we had the TJ's materials have been formally approved and disseminated across thousands of schools. When we started in India, we started in the state of Andhra Pradesh, which at the time had 84 million people, and HIV was such a difficult topic to teach about there. The stigma was the highest among all of India, and it was so high that HIV-positive kids were expelled from schools there. But after working with the governments and the NGOs and building these materials together, the materials have now been systematically distributed across every school in that particular state. So the government had made 25,000 copies and had worked to go into the various schools and teach about this. And thankfully, the young people that were expelled from the schools were let back into their schools.
That's amazing. And have you been able to measure impact of your teaching material in terms of, you know, what effects it's had?
Yeah, everything that we develop is based on research. That's really the core of why we do what we do and how we do it. So each of these countries where we've conducted research, what we do is take our tools and we test them up against whatever the standard materials are in those countries. And all of this research is then conducted through Stanford University. So for instance, in China, we had taken our materials up against the government materials, up against one of the leading NGOs' materials, and run systematic testing to do a pre-test, post-test, retention test control group design. So each of the students across different classrooms get these materials, get various different kinds of materials, and we see how much they've learned and what their attitudes are like. And then after going through the materials, we see, again, how much have they learned, how much have they retained this information. And then we go in, again, a few weeks to several months later to see how they've retained the information and the different learning effects. And the TJ's materials have shown to have statistically significant effects, learning effects in all of these different areas, outperforming all of the standard materials that have been tested against.
Wow. And is there any way, I guess, is there any way of measuring the impact of kind of knowledge and awareness to action?
And Yeah, so we do look at, did they go and seek more information about this? How have their attitudes changed? So there's systematic measures that are conducted in terms of looking at stigma levels and tolerance for these kinds of topics within particular communities. So asking them questions like, would you be willing to go to school with someone who's HIV positive or be friends with someone who's HIV positive? And afterwards, the results of the tests that we've run have shown that people's attitudes have changed significantly.
That's amazing. So I'd love to talk a little bit about your economic model, because one of the notable things about this is you're handing this amazing software out, which is, you know, in many, many different languages, which obviously takes a lot of cost of translation. We'll touch on that in a second about your translation methods. But you're handing this out to, you know, 70 or more countries for free. How did you come to the decision to offer it for free, and how were you able to make that happen?
That was, again, based on the research, and it was really interesting. So when we were looking at a large number of the materials that were available at the time, it was interesting to see that there would be inferior materials, so materials that were incomplete or they were inaccurate. But when they were handed out for free, people would use them abundantly. And yet you would have other materials that were higher quality. And even if they cost a little bit of money, people would go for free every time. A lot of the cases were, you know, it came down to the economics of just, you know, something costing a dollar or even less than that. That's a lot of money for a lot of these different regions and people that we're talking about. But the other issue was education really being this black box. So when you look at research that's conducted and even papers that are published around research for HIV or other kinds of issues like this, basically what they look at is, was education provided or not? And looking at the effects of that versus asking what was the quality of the education that was provided? Was it good quality? And so we knew when we looked at these various populations, different NGOs, governments, and other types of entities, that the fact that they went for free every time, that we wanted to create the highest quality learning materials and that we needed for it to be available for free in order to maximize its use around the world.
That's awesome. And how were you able to make that happen? How were you able to finance that?
We have been extremely fortunate in terms of our financing model. We are able to take money from various corporations and foundations and individuals to be able to develop these materials. And we have hundreds of volunteers. So we have about 300 volunteers right now around the world, including some of the cultural icons I was talking about. All of them donate their time. So what should cost many, many millions of dollars to create in terms of versions, we're able to create at a subsidized cost and therefore be able to make it available for free.
That's awesome. Well, ServiceBase obviously also has a very vibrant volunteer ecosystem. How did you go about setting that up and getting the volunteers and managing them?
A lot of it was just people hearing about what we were doing, and once they saw the impact of the work, they wanted to get their friends involved and their friends involved, and especially when they saw the technical aspects of what we were trying to do, it was really incredible to see them reach out to their friends that had these incredible technical skills to be able to support the work that we were doing. It has been extremely beneficial to be housed out of Silicon Valley, where you have companies like Google and Yahoo and Facebook just around the corner from where we live and work, and obviously attached at the hip of Stanford, where there's so much innovation in terms of learning and technology and growth. And so we've had this outpour of support, both from this area as well as connections from other parts of the world. The other thing that's been really interesting is that because our materials go out to so many thousands or millions of learners, corporations have been very excited to sponsor the development of the versions. From their standpoint, it's a great marketing opportunity to be able to get their logo out in front of so many people and their materials that are going to be used persistently over many years. And so that's been funding that has been incredible because there's no strings attached, and we can then put that directly towards developing the materials and making it available for free.
It's fascinating. It's interesting how much so many answers to your questions, to my questions, come back to that's the result of research. You're obviously very meticulous and painstaking in the manner in which you're approaching this and doing this on very, very careful research. And I know I've seen a talk where you talked a little bit about how you translate stuff and how the painstaking efforts and meticulous efforts you take at translation to make your product culturally sensitive in different countries. And I'd love to hear a little bit, I'd love to hear you describe that a little bit in detail.
Sure. It is an extremely, extremely complex process, and it was grounded in the fact that communication, especially around taboo topics, is so incredibly difficult. So what we do is we'll start with, say, the base English version, and then we get that translated by experts, so people who know how to talk about these issues in the cultural context that we want to work with. We work with medical experts who know how to talk about the biology and transmission-related issues. So we basically work with this team of what we would call fantastic translation experts who would then take the English version and translate into, say, a Hindi version. We then take that version, which should be bulletproof because at this point we've got so many amazing people working on that translation. We take that version and we give it to different people who know how to speak English as well as Hindi, and but that have never seen the original English animation. And we asked them to take that Hindi version and back translate it into English. They think that they're translating it for the first time. And so what's really interesting is once we do this, we look at all of these back translations and we find so many inaccuracies within what we thought was the bulletproof version of the translations. We then take that back translation and we go back and forth until the translation we end up coming up with is very similar to the original translation. And we've been able to avoid all kinds of disastrous situations in being very careful about this translation process. So you may recall I had mentioned that in one of the initial studies that I ran, the number one question that came back around HIV was whether there was a cure, and so much confusion around cure versus treatment. Well, when we were translating the materials in a number of languages in India, the word for cure would sometimes come back treatment, and the word for treatment would sometimes come back as cure in the back translations. And what we discovered was that the word for cure and treatment for a number of the different languages in India were the same. And so we were then able to work with governments and NGOs and different medical experts to talk about, okay, how are we going to teach about this when the word that's being used colloquially is something that is the same? Or in China, when we were translating from English into Mandarin, even though we were working with experts that teach about HIV education, what we discovered was that they had translated every instance of the word breast milk into milk. So now you can get HIV from breast milk, but you can't get it from any kind of milk. And so So in the back translation process, when we were working with all these individuals, what they were asking was, wow, I didn't know you could get it from milk. So can you get it from cow's milk or goat's milk? And no, you can't get it from any of those kinds of milk. And so we were able to identify a lot of these kinds of problems before it went out into the market. But these were problems that were perpetuated the various kinds of materials that were already out there that were being used. So really what we think about in terms of research, there's kind of three points. The first is to figure out what's core to your product success and not to settle for anything less than the best. The second is that customers and learners may use your product for a variety of different reasons. So high quality in all aspects always pays off. And lastly, to use data wherever you can get it and where you can't, that the real innovation is really in inventing a new process to be able to do that research yourself.
Wow. So what in your background, I mean, that kind of back and forth is so much more than anyone else does. What in your background do you think led you to be so incredibly sensitive about language and the need for this kind of very, very careful work?
The idea behind that came from all of these interdisciplinary experts that I was working with. These are people that are extremely busy and working on very, very important problems. And HIV had been a problem for so many, you know, decades before that. We wanted to make sure that if we were using all of these, the time of all these experts and cultural icons and hundreds of volunteers, that we were doing it right. And so every time we started this process and we would see something that led to other questions that really needed to be explored, because perhaps if we didn't think about those questions, we would again be designing materials that wouldn't be extremely effective. We wanted to be able to go back and think about it in a very, very considerate and deliberate way and make sure that we were dotting all our I's and crossing all our T's.
Wow. So how many languages is your software in, roughly, do you know?
We now have 26 versions of our animations, which are being used in different parts of the world. And our goal is to be able to create about 80 different language versions for 50 different countries. So our research has shown that if we can do that, we can develop for these 50 countries that we've identified as having a variety of different persistent problems and teaching about this, then we'll be able to serve 90% of the population across the world that needs these materials most.
Wow. And what is your vision going forward? Are you, do you want to, you know, you have this amazing model now, and, you know, distribution, so to speak, you know, access to schools and people. What's next?
Yeah, so it's been so incredibly exciting to see the momentum behind developing these materials and now the hundreds of partners that we have around the world that's been disseminating these materials and getting it to really even the last mile in terms of people that need these materials. What I envision is being able to take our model and our methodology, which is really where we've spent 5+ years doing the research and perfecting, and being able to create materials not just on HIV education, but on many, many other topics. So anything from other health-related topics like tuberculosis or malaria or hand washing to other kinds of topics like abuse.
Well, that's tremendous. So I know you teach a course at Stanford on research-based intervention to solve global health problems, and I think you've even had Hovey from ServiceBase come speak about Dr. V and the amazing Arvind Eye Hospital. I'd love to hear kind of in your thinking, both in your experience with TJs and in teaching your course, kind of being involved with technology and in solving social issues, you know, what are some of the best practices that you think have emerged about technology and social design and the intersection of the two?
And before you answer, this is Audrey. I'm just going to jump in and remind callers that we'll open up the queue in a minute or two, or the queue's already open, but we'll go and transition into Q&A in a little bit. So if you have questions or comments or any reflections, feel free to hit *6 and you can, you'll get in the queue. You can also email questions in through ask@servicespace.org. So
great.
Go ahead. Yeah, sorry for the interruption. Public service announcement.
Fantastic. Thank you. Britha, to go back to your question, I think that there are really two areas that we emphasize in the class and just generally with the work that we do. The first is the idea around whatever you're designing should be very considerate and deliberate in the design and to be able to use research whenever possible. So we have a lot of people, especially being in Silicon Valley, that come up with all different kinds of ideas and different trends and are more excited about the use of those trends in designing their intervention. So they have the solution before they've even looked at the problem or really listened to the various communities to be able to work with them to be able to come up with more of a grassroots solution. So the first thing is to just listen and use that research and be extremely deliberate and considerate when you're creating these materials. The second thing is what we call the golden rule of social change. So really thinking about designing these interventions together, talking and working with NGO partners and governments and cultural icons and different experts and definitely the learners that you're working with, that these are solutions that emerge out of this very deep understanding and considerate design that you work on together, as opposed to having the solutions before you start.
Yeah, that's great. And how did you involve the community and some of the learners in your process? Did you kind of pilot it extensively, or how did that happen?
It initially started because of the research out of Stanford, where I had reached out to different schools and started to work with young learners that way. But very soon after, it took on a life of its own. So as soon as people saw what we were doing, they wanted to get their friends involved and their kids involved and their parents involved. And so it was really this momentum that drove the work and still continues to drive the work.
That's beautiful. Preeta, if it's okay with you, I'd love to transition. We have a few callers in the queue with some questions.
Fabulous.
All right, so we'll just
thank
go to
you
our
so
next.
Much to both of you for being so kind in your questions and taking the time to listen.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's such a gift to even just hear that, just the ins and outs of all the aspects of all of this and your whole journey. We'll go to our next caller.
Okay.
Hello, this is Michelle Ehlers calling from San Jose. Thank you so much for your work, what you're doing. I spent some of my childhood in Zambia. I've lived in China, and I've spent my life working on cross-cultural communication and, in recent years, transformational global leadership. And I'm so excited to see what you're doing, looking at, you know, what you're looking at from the global perspective when you start looking at how many people we need to reach and how to reach the, you know, that's just... Thank you. Thank you for doing that. It's so important. And I've got a couple of questions of different kinds. One is just the personal. In my experience, you know, there was a question online about how do you handle crossing taboos, and I've been thinking about that. In my experience, one of the best ways to reach other people is not only to understand their taboos and think of ways to get around that, but also to understand our own taboos and deal with that. I'm wondering what taboos of your own have you found that you needed to deal with? And then also, have you been involved or coordinated with the Millennium Development Goals at all and the Sustainable Development Goals that will now be adopted in September? And if not, would you be interested in doing that? I've been working with the development of that, and I'd love to coordinate with you further.
Sure. So I think the first issue around taboos for myself has been to really try to understand what that means. And in developing the materials, one of the biggest lessons that we learned was, instead of challenging those taboos, because a lot of those taboos are they're rooted in laws that can't be changed and other kinds of issues that really are very difficult to change and take years or centuries to be able to combat. What are ways that we can bypass those taboos to really be able to enhance learning and understanding and education? And so in the case of HIV, we were able to do that by using this biology-based approach and then coupling it with culturally appropriate euphemisms. In a lot of the cases, for instance, an example would be kissing. We weren't allowed to show kissing in our materials because you could be sued for doing that. Many people are sued for demonstrating that. But instead of showing a couple kissing, we could show... we could basically piggyback off of old Bollywood movies and show a couple coming very close to kissing, but then the camera pans up a tree and these birds kiss instead. So really thinking and being considerate about the issues with taboos and figuring out other ways to be able to tackle them through bypassing them. Then your other question about the Millennium Development Goals, we have a very close partnership with the United Nations, using our materials in various locations. In Botswana, for instance, we had worked with their Ministry of Education and their Ministry of Health and their former president's office, where UNICEF had funded or partially funded the development of those materials to be able to disseminate them across all the schools in the entire country. So the use of the Millennium Development Goals was heavily debated, and it's something that we work within when we're creating the materials. But I'd love to connect with you further on a personal basis, considering that you're in San Jose to discuss.
Exactly.
Perhaps there's things that we could do to do together to be able to help the situation even further.
Fabulous.
Thank you so much for your questions.
Thank you, Michelle. We'll go to our next caller.
Yes, thank you so much for all you've done in this area. I'm Wendy from Half Moon Bay, and having worked in healthcare for so many years, one of the sticky areas it can be the difference in values between, especially when you're working with teens, parents and children. And certainly in this country where so many people come from other parts of the world. And I'm wondering if you ever target some materials for parents as well as for teens. I mean, the same topic, but teaching in a different way to parents and children, especially about health care.
It was really interesting because when we developed the materials, it was for young people. And but in the process of developing it and actually getting the materials out there and watching the diffusion of the innovation, many, many parents have taken these materials and used it to educate one another. And what we discovered was that when you, if you can basically bring the learning and understanding to a very basic level, that it's something that is useful to people across different generations. So initially when people would look at the materials, older folks like parents and other kinds of educators that would look at the materials, they thought because of the cartoons that it was ideal for young people, but they didn't think about it for themselves. But over and over, time and time again, they have come back and said, oh my goodness, this is actually very useful for us as well. And so they've been using it within their own cultural and learning context.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your question.
Thank you, Wendy. Just a little reminder, if anyone has a question, just hit *6 to get in the queue to ask, or if you even just have some reflections or thoughts, that's great too. I actually had a question as I was listening to you, Pia. It just sounds like you've really delved so deeply into this topic and into so many communities on such a sensitive, you know, aspect of life and society. And I was just wondering, are there any particular moments from this work that really stick out to you? Like, I'm sure there are many, but is there any, you know, specific instance or situation that really impacted or shifted or expanded your perspective and the way that you operate?
Yeah. I think the very first one was when I had gone to India to work on this issue in a more deliberate way. Hello?
Yeah, you're
okay. It's okay.
You're good.
and so much of the research, this goes back to what Britha was talking about with the head and the heart. And I got into the first community, and I had learned about how all of these kids had been expelled from school because they were either HIV positive or they knew people that were HIV positive. My heart just broke. And you realize what a very, very serious issue this is. I mean, you're expelling young kids from school, and they aren't going to have the opportunity to learn so many of the basics that will transform their lives and their families' lives and will make such a huge difference because of something like this. So the seriousness was at such a deeper, more personal level. And it became kind of a dance between the head and the heart. The more you realized that you could do, the more you realized that you didn't know, the more you became empowered to want to learn more, to be able to do more. And I think that the times that are most precious to me are the rare occasions when I can go into the field and watch the young people watch the materials and learn for the very first time. They have no idea about the challenges that we've had in developing the materials, or the politics that we've dealt with, the corruption that we've dealt with, to be able to bring those materials to them in that very moment. And so watching them learn in such an innocent way and their eyes light up and the kids giggle, it's so refreshing and it's so rewarding that you realize, okay, we can go back and continue to do this work because this is the reason we do what we do. And those are the most powerful images that come in my mind up against challenges. Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful. But for me, as I'm listening, I mean, it just strikes me because it's not hard to encounter heartbreaking situations and feel, you know, deeply moved in a certain way, but then to feel deeply moved and then actually act on it and let your heart lead your head in creating something that's of service to that situation. It's pretty profound. So thank you.
I think that all of us that are working in this feel very blessed and very fortunate for the opportunity to be able to do meaningful work, both for others, but more importantly, even for ourselves.
Can you say more about that for yourself?
Yeah.
Like how does this work fuel yourself?
Yeah, I think for myself, I feel incredibly fortunate to wake up every morning and be so excited and energized to be able to do this work. I think so few people have the opportunity to do whatever it is that they want in their lives and to be able to do that full time and to be able to have the support of my family and my friends and my amazing husband and these incredible people that have dedicated so many hours to make this make these materials happen and bring them into the lives of young people. It's an incredible blessing.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. We'll go to our next caller. We think is Devin.
Hi, Audrey. This is Devin from Orange County. Hi, Pia.
Yes.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hi,
today?
Devin.
Hi, Pia. I am listening to the conversation, and I just think it's so empowering for people to have opportunity for really changing their life in a positive way. And my question is a little bit in the same vein as Audrey. If you would share with us a story or two of people that have used this and like the impact on them that you have seen and what you might have heard from them before and after while doing this, I think it'll be very useful to me to listen.
Sure,
to.
Sure. I remember in Kenya, there was this group that was using the TJ's materials and they had sent us these pictures. And the pictures had tiny little laptop on the chair and the table in front of the room. And I remember asking them, you know, how do the kids even see the materials? It's so small, the screen. And this man said to me, you know, you don't even know what you're talking about. This is the very first time that these young people have been able to see animation, let alone in their own language. And when we're trying to describe and teach about these concepts, usually we're drawing in the sand to be able to explain what happens in your body, or if we're lucky to get a chalkboard to be able to demonstrate these different concepts. And for the very first time, they're actually able to watch something that shows what happens when you delve into a person's body. And it just hit me that the power of the tools that we're using, that it is making an impact in the different communities that we go to. There was a soldier in, he was actually a medical doctor in the army that was serving 300 soldiers, and his name was Dr. Paswal, and he had run the HIV exam on a number of his soldiers and was extremely distraught when he found out that many more were infected with HIV than he had originally hoped. And he went out and he found our materials online and he said, can you help me get this to my soldiers? And he said that, you know, we don't have internet in our community. Is that okay? And we said, yes, absolutely. We have CD-ROMs, we have DVDs, we can send some of these to you. So we sent it to him thinking that, oh my goodness, you know, he's one doctor for 300 soldiers. He, who knows if he'll have time to be able to share this and show this. And he sent us this picture of himself in the front with 300 soldiers packed in this room learning for the very first time about this topic. But what was most inspiring was that all these educators in the neighboring villages heard that Dr. Paswal was running this kind of education, and they came to him and said, you know, we want to give our kids this education, but we either feel too embarrassed or we don't know enough. Can you help us? And so then he started to send us pictures, the same room with him standing in the front, but now instead of 300 soldiers, there were, you know, hundreds of kids that were learning about these materials for the very first time. There was this other story from someone who's now become a friend. His name is Saruni in Tanzania. And he, too, had reached out and said that he had been wanting to teach people about HIV because so many people in his community were dying from HIV. And he had seen so many of his close friends and family members suffer from this virus. And so he too said, you know, we don't have internet in our community. Can you help us? And so he said, sure, we've got these CD-ROMs and DVDs. And we sent it over to him. But what was so interesting was that when he told us his story and he showed us his pictures, he was showing it to communities that had no electricity. And he didn't even think to tell us about that because it wasn't, you know, it was a barrier that he was definitely going to work through. And so he had hung these bed sheets on the walls and to be able to teach HIV education to his community, which was the Maasai community for the very first time. And he had found a way to get a battery and a generator from neighboring NGOs to be able to show this and teach this. So it's just incredible because once you can create these materials while working with all of the different experts from different walks of life, it's really these local heroes that make this happen and take it to the people where they can see that the information is needed and that knowledge truly is power. So it's those people who have, we don't know their names and we've never met them, that are able to truly make this happen for people in different communities.
Well, how inspiring a case of
they are so inspiring.
Empowerment.
Yeah, it's incredible. They are so inspiring.
And I just wanted to share this one more thing, Pia and Audrey. I mean, I'm on your website, Pia, on teachaids.org. And just want to say this, I grew up in India and I'm a big fan of Amitabh Bachchan. And it's just a great idea to actually use people like him in rallying kind of like all the people. So, way to go. Like one plus for that as well. Thank you.
It's been really exciting because, you know, we can develop the most robust materials from a research perspective and, like Britha was saying, really using our head to be able to do what we think is right. But the main important part is whether people will use it. And when you have people like Mr. Bachchan or, you know, in Botswana, their former president, Festus Mohai, who the entire country and many countries throughout Africa have this deep respect for, they want to watch it because they trust those people and they believe in them. And when they give those messages, people listen and they learn and they take it to heart in such a different way. And so it really transcends the information from being something that's on paper or something that you see in software to being really integrated into people's hearts and their minds when it's delivered by the right people.
Thank you. That's a great lesson to learn as well.
Well, and some of these people, like Mr. Bachchan, he's incredibly busy. All these celebrities are incredibly busy, and I've seen that with how they're running around and barely sleeping and on so-and-so award show and recording so-and-so music video. And the fact that they have taken so much time and energy out of their very busy schedules to sit down and record this and to really do it right because they want to do right by the learners is extremely inspiring and says a lot about their personality and commitment to society at large.
Mm. Beautiful.
Yeah, I would say it speaks volumes for the pool and power of your idea as well, Pia. So thank you for the call and thank you, Audrey.
Yeah, thank you. And as you're talking, it just really feels to me like it's almost this collective effort.
It is absolutely a collective effort. So, I mean, all I can take credit for is just some of the ideas at the beginning in terms of asking questions around why this wasn't working. But I can absolutely not take credit for the intervention and what's been happening around the world. It really is hundreds of thousands of people who have worked so hard to be able to develop these robust materials and be able to get them to people who need them most.
Wow. I have a feeling that you can take credit for more than that. But it is beautiful. It's almost like you see yourself as an instrument for this work to come through. So that's beautiful. Thank you. We'll go to our next caller now.
Hi, my name is Elisa, and I'm in the Skagit Valley right now, Washington State. And I first want to thank you. I'm so impressed with your work. And when you said it included trust, to me it's all about trust. And even though you're saying, which is true, all these people have been a part of the work, and it is, that's what's so beautiful, it seems to me that inherent peace of listening at such a deep level with respect is so important. And is that deeply a part of you, and that part of you permeated out like a ripple as the process of this whole project to create the success it has?
That's very, very kind of you to say. I think that trust and listening and respect are such important aspects of everyone's lives, and it's something that I grew up with my family, that my parents have instilled, in just working with my sister and I and educating us. But when you realize that people want to do right by each other, and they care about each other, and they love each other, and they want to be able to help one another. When you go down to these basic concepts, it's incredible the power of generosity and how that can translate into a movement to be able to promote education on a large scale.
Yes, and at the same time, what you were saying with that same excitement can be with people who think they know the answer, but they're putting, there's not the essential listening that you or people that you were working with developed, especially in the translation of the question and answer. Uh-huh. But to me, that translation of question, of going back and forth and back and forth between words and concepts in different languages is really something that's essential every day because of connotations of just the way people bring that isn't done in our culture, and yet that is a part of the success of your project or this whole project. And it sounds like it's inherent in your family and needs to permeate the world.
It's something we talk about in the class that I teach pretty deeply, because you have all these young people who are so excited, have so much energy, and have all these really exciting ideas and technology at their disposal, and they come across some, grant to be able to go into country X and be able to test this product that they're excited about. And, the idea of going into these places and realizing that these are people just like you, just like you and your friends and your family, and thinking about people not as test subjects, but as real people who are trying to do right by themselves and their families, and that you can learn so much from going there and listening and helping to be part of the solution through working with them, because in a lot of cases, and in most cases, they know what they want and they know what they need. And so if you can then try to figure out how to bring those tools together to be able to make that happen, that's truly where the magic is. It's not in coming up with the solutions before you even head there, because you honestly, we really have no idea about the problems until you're really in that time and space with the people that are dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, I see the same problem even like when I go to work, whether when I'm dealing with customers, say, and most fellow employees have not the attitude of deep listening. You know, they're we know what they need and we'll do it. I think it's so much deeper than just going into a different culture, mm-hmm. and yet you have succeeded in teaching that, and that to me is that essential piece, or one of them, and thank you. I'd love to learn more how to teach it.
Well, I think that it's a constant learning process for each and every one of us, because every single day we have to remind ourselves of the value of listening and respect and being very considerate. And I think that once you remember how valuable that is, then you kind of get addicted to it because you realize the power behind that thought.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. We'll go to our next caller.
This is Arye from Half Moon Bay, California. Thank you so much, Pia, for what you're sharing with us. And thank you also, Preeta and Audrey, for holding the space of this call. Pia, you said something earlier that kind of intrigued me, a practical challenge, and that is you talked about corruption as one of the challenges that you've needed to get through. And I'm curious about that. How does that show up, and how do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are several levels of that. I mean, anything from, you know, various entities wanting a bribe to show the materials to, you know, wanting all kinds of things. And what has been truly powerful in the process of being able to deal with these challenges is to surround yourself with people who have the same kind of ideas and really want to see this through, and understanding the different incentives that people have and trying to figure out how to then fulfill some of those incentives. We have been surrounded by so many, many good people who have all different assets and connections, who have been able to unhook some of those challenges that we've come against or we've seen others come against. We do not pay bribes through our organization. And so when something like that comes up, it's just about trying to find another creative creative approach to be able to solve that problem. Because you will find in a lot of these cases, there's something that's just much deeper behind the story. And being able to really convince people when they do want money or something like that of the true value of what you're doing and try to gain their respect and their buy-in into what you're doing has been really incredible. Once they see all the kids that would be benefiting from these materials, whether it's them or other people that you can find around you, the power of that has been what has helped us through the process.
So it sounds like having knowing people locally and having local allies is a big part of what you're doing with this.
Absolutely, it's been one of the greatest challenges, but it's been absolutely one of the biggest strengths in us doing this work. So, for instance, there are situations when I'll give you like a more specific example where we've got where we'd like to show the materials on television. That's a way that we actually get it out to many, many people around the world. And in order to show materials on television, typically you would have to get sponsorships and pay quite a bit of money to be able to do that. And there are other places where there is corruption associated with it, where they would like to get paid under the table to be able to show the materials. But in the process of learning about those challenges, we do have people that are located in key places who can make a phone call and be able to share the benefits of what we're doing and be able to unhook some of those challenges. So in India, for instance, one of the government channels that we wanted to be able to show the materials on, we were able to get a few of the ministers of the country to call in and say that you should show these materials and here are the benefits of showing the materials. Now, I didn't have connections to those ministers, but it turned out that people we knew people who knew people, and everyone was determined to make this happen. So it's really been, again, it's a story of the power of people and their passion to be able to make this happen.
Very interesting. Thank you, Pia.
You know, Pia, this is Prita again. You say that in a very modest way, but I mean, there's been hundreds and thousands of initiatives, whether they're ed tech or any other kind, that people try, you know, all really well-intentioned and capable people trying to do good things in the world, that kind of hit the wayside after a while. To have the kind of adoption rates you have, to have the kind of impact you have, you know, I'm trying to get at what is it other than just clearly an outstanding product, but there's obviously the extra oomph that's there that makes this go. And is it, you know, your ability to find incredible partners in the field that must come in part from you? And, you know, how much time do you spend in the field? I mean, that's one set of questions. And then I think as we close out, I'd love to hear from you as to how this whole experience and this whole, you know, ability to serve in this way has impacted you and how it's transformed you.
You know, I have met a number of people that have done work on incredible interventions. And once they start hitting up, I mean, against some of these enormous challenges, especially after going through it for years, it can get very exhausting and taxing. And I think that what can keep you going is to reconnect with the reasons why you're doing this. And if there is this deep fulfillment that you have within yourself, then, you know, the work that's happening around the world is really it's a side effect of you loving to do the work, you know, internally. And what I've seen over and over is that when people see the impact that this is having, it motivates them to do more because they realize that, wow, life is bigger than just myself, and that I can take these tools that I've learned about in school or this technology that I know I'm really good at building, and I can put that together with the design talents that someone else has or the voice talents that someone else has, and you bring all of these different talents together, and we can actually solve a problem. And there's something so powerful and motivating in knowing that your life can hopefully have meaning, and thinking about everything that you've been given to come to that moment in your life where you can give back is pretty empowering.
What a perfect note to end this on. Thank you so much for your incredible work, your incredible story, and your sharing it with us.
No, thank you. Thank you for this platform for people to come together and share these kinds of stories. It's very inspiring for all of us that are in the field doing the work. Thank you.
Thank you, Pia. And just one last final question is, how can we in our ecosystem support you and your work?
I think you're already doing it. I think putting something together like this show where people can share their lessons learned and they can come together and talk about what inspires them, that's really what inspires me. I have a number of dear friends like Pavitra, who is just absolutely incredible, who go through various challenges, and what's really inspiring is to be able to share each other's stories so that you don't feel alone in the work. You realize that there are so many people that are working towards something very similar in their own way and in a different way. And just that feeling of togetherness is incredibly motivating and supporting. So I thank you for putting this this show together where hopefully it's igniting different ideas in different people and inspiring them to take action in their everyday lives or something that may go beyond that as well.
Thank you, Pia. It's just been beautiful to spend the last 90 minutes listening and sharing this space and, you know, hearing about your incredible, just hearing the incredible integrity and clarity it feels that you have in your work and in your daily life with this, with the clarity of purpose that you have with this. And, you know, whether you're working with someone like Amita Bhattan or or a doctor, or, you know, the faceless, nameless people that actually carry it out in their own creative ways. For me, what I hear is that you have this eye for humanity and a heart of connection to it, and that that weaves together this incredible project and initiative that is so much more than just a product, but really just a way of serving others and in so serving yourself. So thank you so much. And to end the call, we'll just close with a minute of gratitude and in silence.